accession number 23370, reel 19.
This is the 10th reel of a taped interview with Peter Gray in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 17th of the 4th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. I wanted to speak to, as I understand, the internal running of the jail was left to your own people.
That's right.
And as I understand, earlier on, you were expected to maintain a certain standard of order, particularly as regard being soldiers. Was this something that was maintained right through?
Oh, yes. Particularly when we got back to Changi, when we got to Changi, they the organisation there was still very much in the military style, which helped to maintain morale and that sort of thing very much so. But even when we were in the depths of Burma, in the middle of the wet season, that discipline and control still remained quite constantly the whole time. It never wavered very much at all. Somewhat, of course, when we're in the jungle, the circumstances were that a lot of it remained personal control, etc. But I was never aware of any of these things getting out of hand at any time. So it was there for the whole period.
In Changi, black market, things like that, in the jail?
Oh, absolutely. For the people who had been there for pretty well the whole time and knew the area and knew the people outside, there was a constant black market, and particularly for things like gold or jewellery of any sort, that was always good. And a lot of this was done night time. Most of the contacts were at night time, going out through the wire. And of course, when you were in the actual jail itself, getting out at night was a very difficult thing, because you only got to shut the gate and bingo, you're in. You know, that's it. But black market was always rife, and there was always in Changi itself, with a large number of people, it was also quite a surprising amount of money, not only invasion money, but Singapore dollars and Malay dollars and Australian money and English money were still floating around. I'm not quite sure how they managed it. Anything is possible when you're in that position, as far as the black market was concerned, and there was quite a lot of gambling and this sort of thing.
What about the sort of development of things like gangs within the prison system?
Yes, I believe there were. There was, as a matter of fact, in Changi itself, there was one murder. It was fairly well hushed up, but there was a problem with the count. And as I've said before, this Tenko business, this counting, that was pervasive right the way through the whole issue. And they had a count this particular night, and it was one missing. And of course they did all sorts of things to flum the account and make it appear there was nobody missing. But four toilets, we had boreholes. These were quite big holes that were put down with an auger into the ground, and of course there was a seat on top of it, and that's what you used for going to the toilet. And apparently this bloke was disposed of and bung down the one of these boreholes, but that was the only time that I was aware of anything like that going on. But quite obviously there were gangs within the whole setup somewhere, because when we were in the jungle and on other big working parties, there was no time nor energy to put into anything like that. But in Changi there was a certain amount of floating population that never ever moved from Changi, and within that population obviously they developed some of the cliques and what have you, but they certainly flourished, and they certainly had some better times than what we had as the working part of the business. But I believe there were some gangs. Well, I never got involved with those people. Thank you.
The sort of policing of rules and regulations, how was that to show itself?
As well as the normal operation that were done by officers and NCAs and that sort of thing, that was about the breakdown of it. It was just done through normal military operations. There were some, what do they call them, regimental police in there, but they weren't evident by their uniform or anything else. I don't think they would have been going to have made themselves obvious anyway, because they were never very popular at any time, you know, in the normal run of service operations. But yes, it was mainly done just by the normal functions of NCAs and officers.
In regard the coming of the end of the war, and given the fact that you were concerned about, you know, what might happen with this gun, had you sort of made plans amongst yourselves as to what might happen, what you might do?
No. There was a lot of talk about getting on a boat or going pinching a boat or something. And if this thing occurred, then of course the obvious thing to do was to get the hell out of it as quick as you could. At the time, we were living in the area at the back of the jail, in these huts out the back, and we could get through or get out back into the jungle part of the island very quickly, wouldn't it? So that was sort of our main aim, was away from the effect of the gun and get the hell out of it. But, go towards the some of the areas where you could get a boat of some sort and at least get off the island and get somewhere, you know, with the hope you could be picked up later on. But they were pretty nebulous sort of things, and you relied more than ever on the fact that Yes, the skies were ours and the oceans were ours, so it became quite a thing.
Do you recall VE Day on May the 8th?
Yes, we knew about it, but there wasn't very much. There was plenty of rejoicing as far as we were concerned, but of course it wasn't very obvious. The Japs weren't extremely happy about it, but because they were virtually on their own at that time. But when that VE Day came through, yes, we were extremely happy about it and made a few noises amongst ourselves about it, but nothing was, we didn't jeer at the Japs or anything like that. It was still a bit too far off.
Did their actions towards you deteriorate, or were they harsher towards you at all?
No, very, very, well, I use the word sullen, but that was about the strength of it. They were obviously upset about it and very annoyed that their partners in crime, if you like, had let them down. That was the general impression that we got out of it. But as I say, it wasn't very politic to go around jeering at them about it. But you were talking about the escape bit of it a little while ago. At one of these tankos that we had every night, we were all lined up outside. Everybody lined up outside their own hut, and they come along and they were counted. One of the Japs was counting and one of our people were counting, and then they went and did all their figures afterwards. But right in the middle of this camp, when everybody was standing, waiting to be counted, etc., and there's this enormous blast, and of course everybody at that time was sort of a little bit on edge because you didn't know whether our people were going to come and land or, you know, what was going to go on. There's this enormous blast and stuff started to fly everywhere and people started to dodge and this sort of thing. And oh, there was a hell of a to-do went on. And what it was that a couple of these blokes had been making hooch, and they'd got some sweet potatoes and a couple of other things and made all this hooch, buried it, and of course the bloody stuff went off. It blew these bottles or these jars of stuff to hell and gone. But oh, the noise that it made, blew up, and there was stuff, dirt flying everywhere. We weren't sure whether the invasion was on at that particular time or not. But
what was the response with the
from the Japs? Oh, God, they ran everywhere and cocked rifles and God knows what. So it got a bit hairy, but finally they were convinced that that's all it was. But then, of course, that was they came out with the edict that nobody shall start and brew up hooch. But, of course, it was too late by then. Just a bit of a panic thing.
What was the hooch like?
Raw and very violent. It was not good stuff at all. There weren't too many drank it, but you'd want to be pretty desperate to start and drink some of that stuff. That was, you know, made out of raw potato and that sort of thing. So it was violent stuff if you were addicted to it. But
you mentioned earlier the hearing of the dropping of the atomic bombs. What had been your experience of the coming of the end? Had the guards suddenly disappeared?
No, they didn't disappear. They stayed right to the end. They became, as I say, they've become a little more tolerant, if anything, and were a bit more lenient as far as their attitudes were concerned. And then, of course, when we found out that we had walked around the corner of the jail and found this bloke there trying to buy money, he knew that it wasn't far away. But the end, when it came, was quite dramatic, as far as we were concerned. We had a bomber come over, and this bomber came over very low, and suddenly the air was full of leaflets. And of course the chaps immediately said, don't touch them, don't touch them. You know, that was their attitude. Nobody shall pick them up. You know, but of course that was a bit bloody foolish, to say the least of it. And of course on these leaflets they were saying, you know, the troops will be there shortly, you'll be freed, but in the meantime don't eat any native food. You know, all this sort of stuff that they put out, irrespective of the fact that we've been eating it for the last 3.5 years, but and don't drink any local wines or, you know, that sort of thing. Well, but when the end finally came, what was his name? Tarouchi, Count Tarouchi. He was the bloke that was in charge of the Southeast Asian Command. He was based in Singapore. Mountbatten was based in Rangoon. And he called on Tarouchi to present himself to Rangoon with his sword so it could be taken off him. And of course this was an enormous blow as far as he was concerned. Just before that the thing had finished, the emperor had said, that's it, call it a day. But Tarouchi said, no, he said, I'm not gonna surrender. It's against my principles to surrender. So Mountbatten said, well, right, you can stay there, but within 12 hours I'll have bombers on their way to the Imperial Palace to bomb the Imperial Palace. Take it or leave it. Tarouchi said, no, he wasn't going to surrender. That was it, you can do what you like. You know, words to that effect. In the meantime, the bombers had started. They were on their way. And Rangoon sent the message, the bombers are on their way. There's a plane coming down to Singapore. Be on it with your sword. So the bombers were staved off. He was going to go up and surrender his sword. They got down to Singapore to pick him up. They sent down this Air Force plane, and he was still in his pajamas. He was sick. He didn't want to go. They just grabbed him and chucked him in the plane, sword and all, in his pajamas, and shunted him off to Rangoon. He had to surrender in his pajamas and give his sword away. Terrible loss of face and, you know, this sort of thing. So that was our hairy moment, a very hairy moment, when this bloke said, no, we're going to fight on. That was very, very touchy as far as we were concerned. But of course, then the British came in, and it was six blokes they came in and took over the island. And I've never seen anything like it. This bomber came in, quite relatively low, and the airfield was just wasn't far away from us. And we saw these blokes jump out of the plane, come down in parachutes, and only seemed to be just open the parachutes, they're on the ground. And the next thing, they're up at the gates of Changi. So, of course, in the meantime, our administration had said, nobody is to move. Don't drift a foot. Stay exactly where you are. And you'll be, you know, it'll all be in train very shortly, but nobody is to move. It's too dangerous. So these blokes, when they landed, there was a captain, a doctor, two medicos, and two sergeants, came down on the ground. This was the story afterwards, we found out afterwards. They came in and down on the airfield, dropped their parachutes, of course, and up came a very friendly Japanese driver with a truck to pick the blokes up, doing a little bit of PR work, and out come these automatic guns, and turfed the bloke out of his seat and took his rifle off him and chucked it away and this sort of thing, and then put him back in the driver's seat and said, right, down to the, we want to go to the jail, or made motions for it. He knew what was required, so they got down as far as the guardhouse on the airfield, disarmed that lot, put them on the back of the truck, and or put the arms on the back of the truck, and off they went up to the Changi place, and went in there, did the same thing there, disarmed the guard at the front gate, and then the bloke in charge of the jail, a captain or whatever he was, come out, and one of the brigadiers or colonels from our mob, he brought the head serang of the Japs out, and they filched his sword off him and told him to get back into the guardhouse, you know, that sort of thing. But that's just half a dozen blokes came out. And of course, once they got there, then the word went back into Singapore, it's all over, you know. No worries. But we still didn't move, not for a day or so. And then we found that the...
was it a bit difficult to believe that it had all...
Oh yes, yeah, quite amazing that suddenly it was no longer there. The barriers were no longer there. And that's what you'd had all the time. You'd had this barrier in front of you the whole time. Not so much fear, but the consequences of trying to break through that barrier were not worth it. And to try and... even if you got out of the grip of the Japs, you still had to get somewhere and be able to do something. So you needed organisation and you needed equipment and gear and so forth to be able to do that. Plus you needed your health. Your health was pretty flimsy up in those parts. So yes, there was this enormous barrier was there the whole time. It wasn't only the physical presence of the Japs, it was everything else.
It must have been a bit of a temptation to just get up and walk out.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of blokes went for a bit of a stroll and this sort of thing. Bubbles Elliot and I, we went down and shot off down to some some Chinese people, and about the only thing we could that we had that was of any value at all was soap. So we took down a bundle of soap with us and gave it to these people and sat it and chatted at us there, but I didn't know what the devil they were saying. Anyway, they didn't understand us, but it was all shake hands all the way around, you know, all that sort of thing. But the HMS Sussex came into Singapore, and Bubbles and I jumped on a truck and went into Singapore and went down to the and found the Sussex, and of course we were given a right welcome on board there, and of course all they tried to do was to stuff us with food, you know, that sort of thing, but you can't eat that much. But a great deal of joy, etc., in finding us and us finding them, that sort of thing.
The extent of the celebration in Changi and also around Singapore, could you describe that to us?
Well, it was just elation, more than anything. You had nothing. Nobody had anything. Those that were sick, I guess that improved their lot quite considerably, because the Red Cross came in pretty quickly with food and medicines and that sort of thing. We were cheered to a great extent by people like Pamela Mountbatten and her group of ladies, etc., came in, and of course they were a great boost to your morale, etc., to know that you hadn't been forgotten, and that things were starting to move, etc. And they moved pretty quickly from there on in. I think within a month there was a whole bundle of people had been moved, had gone. It was quite a time of wholesale joy at the time, because of the change that had occurred. The Japs were sort of tolerated, but I guess there was a lot that I didn't know that that would have gone on. It would have been old scores settled and that sort of thing, because there was a lot of intense brutality had taken place, and unnecessary brutality, and terrible treatment as far as the population was concerned, and they wouldn't forget. And there would have been a whole lot of people would have settled scores. Whether it was the correct person or not didn't seem to matter very much at that time. They were getting rid of their frustrations and their years of repression, etc. So they didn't like the British very much, but they liked the Japs a hell of a lot less, because at least the British were giving them a reasonable living, and they had some future. But with the way that the Japs were absolutely raping the place, pillaging it, and that occurred in all areas. It was just this absolute pillaging, and all returning, or everything going back to Japan. It was a just an outright pirating of anything at all. And people were just sick of it. There was no return for them. There was nothing coming back. And I guess this would have accounted for a lot of the people who had very sour visions of the occupation by the Japs. It was quite disastrous from their point of view. But I didn't hang around in Singapore very long. Within a few weeks, I was on a plane being flown out.